Thank you very much for this introduction. And apologies again that I'm not giving this talk in French. So to begin with, to give you a little bit of an idea how I got to this topic, the beginning of my interest in it is the reading of a 12th century exegesis, Quranic exegesis, by a Persian scholar, Fakhreddin al-Razi, who wrote his work in Arabic. And so in this 30-volume long commentary on the Quran, he gives us the following anecdote. I quote, Galen recounted the writing of his book on the usefulness of the body parts, in the chapter of the eye. I withheld from the people the mention of God's wisdom in creating two nerves that unite at a specific point in the eye. Then I saw in a dream that an angel descended from heaven, saying, O Galen, your God says, why do you withhold from my servants mention of my wisdom? He said, I awoke and composed a book on this topic. What surprised me about this passage was that it brought together the figure of Galen of Pergamon, the second century Greco-Roman physician, and the Abrahamic motive of a god sending an angel to intervene in human affairs. I must admit that I suspected that Razi had made up the story, although later on I found that he didn't. In fact, it's slightly biased, but certainly a translation from Galen. But not long after, I came across the mention of the same work, The Usefulness of the Body Parts, in Arabic, Manafi' al-A'dha, a text written in Greek, but generally known under its Latin title, De Uso Partium, this time by the 11th century literateur Abu Hayyan al-Tawhidi in his Muqabasat. Although he made no mention of angels, al-Tawhidi was clearly struck by the work and said that it almost seemed like, I quote, a product of revelation and divine inspiration. Over the years, I've come across more and more reference to this Manafi' al-A'dha. I want to give you a little bit of a of my primary of my preliminary results on the effect this work had on Muslim theology. I want to show that how Galen's work, both directly through the 9th century translation by Hunayn ibn Ishaq, and indirectly through a chain of derivative works that began in Christian late antiquity, was translated and received in the Islamic era, has given crucial impulses to Muslim ideas regarding the observation of the world and subsequent reasoning about its structure and divine origins. The influence of Galen's work can be traced in the works of such diverse Muslim thinkers as Al-Jahid, Avicenna, Al-Ghazali, Averroes, Ibn al-Nafis, Ibn Taymiyyah, to mention only a few. It is also evident in the writings of important Christian thinkers, such as Diodorus of Tarsus, Theodoret of Cyrus, as well as those of Jewish thinkers, such as Yehuda Halevi and Ibn Pakuda, and Moses Maimonides, all originating in Muslim Spain. But I will limit myself today to discussing the Muslim scholars and their theological works. Galen of Pergamon was one of the most significant physicians of antiquity, and his books on medicine remain standard works into the modern era. And that's also how he's discussed in Islamic studies as a famous physician, and it's people who are interested in medical history that study him. However, not unusually in the pre-modern context, Galen was not only a physician but also a philosopher. A fusion of medical and philosophical concerns is evident in his famous work, De Uso Partium. At first sight, this work is a detailed exposition of human anatomy. But a closer look shows that the anatomical observations serve as exposition of, as data for what Galen himself describes as a sacred discourse composed as a true hymn of praise to our Creator, through which we can come to know God's wisdom, power, and goodness. Galen's strategy to achieve this effect is to elucidate the various anatomical features of the body and their suitability for facilitating human life. Recognition of such purposefulness in creation, he argues, leads towards knowledge of the Creator, who is perceived as a demiurge, as a divine artisan who has fashioned the world out of pre-existing matter. This approach, which is variously known as the teleological argument or the argument from design, had been introduced into Greek philosophical discussions already centuries before Galen. But the De Usurpatium was by far, as far as I can see, the most extensive work on the topic produced in antiquity. Unsurprisingly, Galen's argument from design lent itself well to the Abrahamitic religions, and we find late antiquity Christian works such as Nemesius's On the Nature of Man from the late 4th century and Theodoret of Cyrus's On Divine Providence from the 5th century drawing clearly on the Usurpatium. Islamic thought engages with Galen's ideas on design explicitly for the first time in the 3rd Islamic, in the 9th century, indirectly through interaction with earlier Christian works that I just mentioned, and directly through the complete translation that was carried out by the two Christian translators, Hubeish and Hunayn ibn Ishaq, who translated it first from Syriac and then from Greek into Arabic. This translation is extant in 5 copies, one of them here at the Bibliothèque Nationale. At least 5 copies that I know of, that I've found. The indirect path is clearly visible in 2 works from the ninth century. So it's the 9th century is the period in which this material came into Islamic thought. So the indirect path is visible in 2 works from the 9th century with similar titles, both of them attributed to the famous writer Al-Jahith. One of them called Ad-Dalail wal-I'tibar, Indications and Consideration. The other one is called Al-Ibar wal-I'tibar, Examples and Consideration. Both of them have been printed, and both of them printed in the early 20th century and attributed to Al-Jahith. However, the attribution of the first work has been questioned by modern scholarship, and my research suggests that it was in fact written by a Christian physician to the Abbasid court in Baghdad, by a man called Jibril ibn Nuh al-Ambari. This Jibril came from a family of influential Christian churchmen. His grandfather, Abu Nuh al-Ambari, was the Catholicos of Nisibis in the so-called Jazira of Upper Mesopotamia, who already was known as a translator of Greek texts into Arabic. Ambari, who is, as I mentioned, a physician to the Abbasid court, writes this work and includes in it the descriptions of various things, of the cosmos, of flora and fauna, and eventually the largest part, again, on human anatomy, and amounts to an overarching argument for divine providence from design, intelligible in nature. The second text, which I still believe was written by Al-Jahith, who was a contemporary to Al-Ambari and who, with him, was active at the Abbasid court, but he was Muslim, justifies itself as a rewriting of Al-Ambari's work, which he claims rightly is written in very awkward and unelegant Arabic. But also he says in the introduction that he has used several other works in this writing, and he mentions pre-Islamic works, the Book of Reflection by Diodorus of Tarsus, who died in around 390, and on Divine Providence by Theodoret of Cyrus from a century later. Diodorus' work is no longer extant, as far as I can see, but Al-Jahith mentions it in the context of Diodorus' opposition to the pagan emperor Julian the Apostate, who reigned from 361 to 63, so it was likely a defense of Christian theology. Theodoret's De Providentia is extant and has been published. It provides a defense of divine providence by appealing to, among other things, the beneficial design of the human body. It contains clear systematic parallels with both these two works, Al-Dalail wal-Ibar, but one example, all 3 works make the argument that the human speech organ is the model for musical instruments. All 3 likewise follow Galen's the usurpatium in drawing a teleological inference from the anatomical description of eyelashes and eyebrows. It's a big deal, everybody quotes it, the idea that eyelashes are very useful, they keep things out of the eye, and eyebrows, the interesting thing about eyebrows is that the hair doesn't keep growing, which would impair vision, so it stops growing, which, well, at least for most people, which helps, which enables us to grow, to see. Both in its direct and the reason why I say this now, because we're going to return to this in a moment a little bit. Both in its direct and indirect version, Galen's ideas entered Islamic thought in the 9th century separately. And in order to illustrate the breadth of influence that the direct translation exerted on Islamic thought, I will touch upon five topics. First, the question of prophecy. Second, the structure of divine creation as the promotion of benefit and avoidance of harm. Third, law as part of God's teleology. And fourth, a natural theology that connects human experience with the Quran. That's only four. I don't know why I said five at the beginning. Beginning with the first issue, despite the large area of overlap between Galen's account of creation and Abrahamic notions, the issue of prophecy clearly separates the two. In fact, in De Usurpatium, Galen juxtaposes the Aristotelian account of creation with that of Moses, and clearly favors the former, which earned him a harshly worded refutation by Maimonides in the 13th century. However, in the work of Avicenna, two centuries earlier, we find an earlier and alternative approach in using this account, namely an attempt to turn Galen's own teleological argument against him in order to demonstrate the necessity of prophecy. I quote now from Avicenna's Shifa. In it he says, "Reciprocal transactions between people must have law and justice, and law and justice necessarily requires a lawgiver and a dispenser of justice. This lawgiver must be in a position that enables him to address people and make them adhere to the law. He must then be a human being. He must not leave people to their private opinions concerning the law so that they disagree, each considering as just what others owe them, unjust what they owe others. Thus, with respect to the survival and actual existence of the human species, the need for this person, which by which he means a prophet, is greater than the need for such benefits as growing of hair on the eyebrows and the palpable margins, and concave shaping of the arches of the feet, and many other things that are not necessary for survival, but are at best useful for it." Avicenna here formulates a fortiori argument in direct response to Galen, from whose work stems the second part of the quotation, that is, the description of the benefits of eyebrows, eyelashes, etc. If we can observe divine providence in anatomical details, then the sending of prophets in order to facilitate social life, which for Avicenna is the primary reason for the divine law brought by prophets, is even more appropriate to divine providence. Apart from the issue of prophecy, Avicenna's attitude to Galen's empiricist approach, i.e. the approach of observing individual patterns of reality and then reasoning to higher things such as the creator and the nature of his creating, is critical but not hostile. So in Avicenna's Pointers and Reminders, acknowledges that the argument from design, even though he discounts it vis-a-vis the superiority of metaphysical arguments for God's existence. Avicenna is well known for devising the so-called ontological proof of God that became very influential in Islamic thought, also influenced medieval Christian theology a lot. So for him, contemplating pure being is sufficient to establish God's existence and oneness. It is not necessary to consider God's creation, even though, he says, it is an indicator towards him. وَإِنْ كَانَ ذَلِكَ دَلِيلًا عَلَيْهِ. And he argues that while contemplation of creation yields only probable knowledge, since it's inductive, the contemplation of God's self leads to certain knowledge, because it is a deduction from certain premises. And in fact, he uses a Quranic proof text for this. The second example of Galen's influence concerns the nature of the world as revealing divine providence. From the element of design that he sees as ever-present in creation, Al-Ghazali, the famous 12th century Muslim theologian and philosopher, inductively concludes that the goal of creation is to promote benefit and to avoid harm. For example, a description of the various benefits of water leads to conclusions regarding God's intentions and nature. So he says in one of his works, "So behold the vastness of the blessing and the ease of accessing it, and yet our unawareness of its real value despite the intensity of the need for it, to the extent that were it to become scarce, life in this world would become miserable and even impossible. From this we know that God, by sending it down and making it easy to procure, wished the world to be inhabited by animals and plants, as well as providing other benefits so bountiful that someone trying to enumerate them will fall short. So praise to the great dispenser of favors." The great 13th century Muslim scholar and physician Ibn Nafis took this empiricism even further. Thoroughly familiar with the Usuppartium, even composing an abridgment of it, and including in his commentary on Avicenna's Anatomy a chapter titled "The Proof of the Beneficial Nature of the Body Parts." In this chapter, Ibn Nafis clearly links the issue of teleological anatomy with theological discussions when reporting that some thinkers reject the beneficial nature of the body parts because they reject the idea that God creates for a purpose. The problem here is that one would posit a motivation outside of God that compels God to create in that way. Ibn Nafis replies, I quote, "In truth, this is not correct. Even if God is not acting for a purpose, his actions are nevertheless not devoid of wisdom. Otherwise, existence would be futile, and that is impossible." Ibn Nafis does not go so far as to contravene the dominant theological Sunni position that God does not act motivated by a purpose, but he nonetheless defends the notion that God's actions are characterized by wisdom, that is, they are intelligibly structured and not haphazard. The importance of the existence of teleology and its recognition for Ibn Nafis becomes clear in his Theologus Autodidactus, the sequel to Ibn Tufayl's Hayy ibn Yaqzan, the kind of philosophical novel in which somebody grows up on an island, isolated from other people, isolated from society, and has to reason their way to understand the world. So already Ibn Tufayl's version becomes aware of the benefits of the body, of the body parts, a motive that already has parallels to Galen. But in Ibn Nafis' narrative, the investigation of the protagonist, whose name is Kamil, into the design of the body is far more extensive and crucial for his recognition of God than in Ibn Tufayl's version. In the chapter titled "How Kamil Acquired Knowledge and Wisdom," Kamil begins by observing the functioning of his limbs and its appropriateness to sustaining him, and thereby, I quote, "discovers many benefits of the exterior body parts." It is this observation of order and design that forms the basis of Kamil's discovery of the existence of a creator. The third influence of Galenic teleology lies in the realm of law, surprisingly, I would think. While the early rationalist Mu'tazili ethics in Islam managed to integrate law seamlessly into a wider landscape of creation structured by God's obligation to bring about the optimum. So these early Muslim theologians argued that through his nature, God is obligated to create the best of all worlds. And that's why law is part of this and therefore has to be beneficial. Later Muslim theologians, the school that became dominant, were voluntarists. They rejected this system without replacing it with a coherent account of divine action or legislation, arguing that God is not ethically obligated to create the best of all possible worlds. One of Al-Ghazali's primary achievements was to develop a conceptualization of the law that re-established its purposefulness, not by means of deductive top-down reasoning, i.e. from the nature of God about how the law has to be beneficial, as in the Mu'tazili approach, but rather inductively. Again, this is the area of the issue of induction is important here, through observation of individual phenomena, that is, individual human needs and individual rules of the law. So what he says is, we cannot assume that the law has to be beneficial to us. God could order us to do things that are harmful for us. They would still be obligatory to us. But we can just observe the law, we can observe the features of the law, and find that they in fact do serve human needs. And the five large pillars of human needs that he mentions when analyzing Islamic law is the preservation of life, the preservation of religion, the preservation of property, the preservation of lineage, and of reason. So this process enabled Al-Ghazali not only to propose a fundamental harmony between the two, but also to develop a method for analogically extending this harmonious relationship. So once you have come to the conclusion that the law serves these goals, if you then approach a new legal question, you can use these five aims of the law to test it. Is this legal solution acceptable? Does it serve the preservation of life, property, lineage, etc.? The classical legal historians of Islam were puzzled by the origins of Al-Ghazali's new model, given that it had no obvious forerunners. What I believe, and have argued in much more detail elsewhere, is that Al-Ghazali's encounter with Galen's De Usu Partium is the primary theoretical inspiration for this new approach to the law. Al-Ghazali knew Galen's work well. He recommended it enthusiastically in his autobiography, and he wrote a separate work titled The Wisdom of God's Creation, which drew on the Usu Partium as well as on the indirect tradition from Al-Jahith and Al-Ambari to give an account of how the observation of nature leads one to discover God and his attributes. In this work, Al-Ghazali adopted and used the complex terminology of the Arabic translation of the Usu Partium, including terms such as benefit and harm, purposefulness, appropriateness, etc., that already Hunayn had coined in this translation of Galen. It is this same terminological toolkit that Al-Ghazali used to develop a theorization of law as just another feature of creation that can be empirically studied, a study that leads to the realization that the aims of the law are to promote benefit and avoid harm. Finally, and this is the fourth, I think if I count correctly, Al-Ghazali's work also demonstrates another dimension of Galenic influence in Islamic thought. He explicitly links Galen's account of design in nature to the numerous Quranic references to divine design in nature. Al-Ghazali embeds the Galenic empirical approach firmly in a scriptural framework by establishing inherent links between the two. He begins his work with a Quranic verse, say, "Behold what is in the heavens and on earth," thereby defining the empirical approach as the execution of a divine command. Furthermore, he introduces each section of the work with a Quranic verse that demonstrates the correlation between empirical observation and revelation. For example, in the issue of fetal anatomy, he brings a verse of the Quran that refers to the development of the embryo as a sign of God's wisdom. Most interesting, however, are Al-Ghazali's reflections on the nature and potential of empiricism. In his autobiography, he says, "The natural philosophers are a party who devote most of their efforts to investigating the natural world and the wonders of animal and plants and plunge into the science of the anatomy of the parts of animals. And what they see there of the wonders of God's craftsmanship and the inventions of his wisdom compels them to acknowledge a wise creator who is aware of the ends and purposes of things. No one can study anatomy and the wonders of the benefits of the parts without acquiring the necessary knowledge of the perfection of the governance of the of the constructor in the construction of animals and especially the construction of human beings. That's the positive side. However, in his magnum opus, in his Revival of the Religious Sciences, he also expresses where he parts with these natural philosophers. He says, when the natural philosopher considers all that we've considered here, his consideration might be a cause of his misguidance and misery. And when the divinely aided person considers it, it will be a cause of his guidance and felicity. Everything in the heavens and the earth can be a source of guidance and of misguidance. Al-Ghazali stresses that observation of the same phenomena by someone following divine guidance on the one hand and by a natural philosopher on the other hand can lead into two diametrically opposed directions, the former to guidance and bliss and the latter to misguidance and misery. After all, Galen rejected prophecy and professed belief in the eternity of the world in this very same De Usuppagium. Al-Ghazali's justification for this conclusion, namely the statement that everything in the cosmos can serve as a means of guidance and of misguidance, clearly refers to the Quranic verse in which it says, God guides by the Quran whom he wishes and leads astray with it whom he wishes, and he misleads no one but the evildoers. Here then we have come full circle. Observing nature and reading the Quran have been integrated into a single epistemological spectrum. Natural phenomena, in Al-Ghazali's conceptualizations, are signs pointing towards God in precisely the same way that the verses of the Quran are literally signs. In fact, verses, Quranic verses in Arabic, actually are called signs. By equating the signs in nature and the signs in scripture, Al-Ghazali is in fact raising the status of empirical observation and justifying the validity of its results in contrast to the more dismissive attitude displayed by Avicenna towards contemplation of creation as a path to knowledge. To conclude, the history of the argument from design in the Islamic intellectual tradition has not yet been written. And as you will have noticed, this presentation can be no more than a sketchy suggestion of the breadth of topics that are connected to it and the spectrum of famous thinkers who have engaged with it. Galen's De Usuppagium has played an important part in this debate, both directly and indirectly. What is so interesting about the subject is that it contradicts the usual stereotypical account of the Greek philosophical tradition and Islamic scripture coming into conflict with the former having to give way to the latter in the so-called post-classical era. In this case, important scholars such as Al-Ghazali, Averroes, Ibn Nafis, and Ibn Taymiyyah emphasized the overall harmony between Galen's work and the Quran and used this to argue for a way to approach God through experiencing his creation, an empiricism. This is an empiricist methodology, rather than the rationalist Avicennan philosophical approach and its metaphysics, particularly its ontological proof of God. Finally, it's remarkable how much less controversial Galen's empiricism was in Islamic theology than the rationalism of the peripatetic philosophers. The primary reason for this was the affinity between Galen's argument and the Quran, which contains countless and recurring encouragement to observe the various features of the natural world as signs of the divine. So Al-Ghazali's merger of Quranic verses and Galenic ideas appears to have recovered an element that was already present in the Quran. The cluster of works discussed above shows that teleology, in particular Galen's ideas, had been a hot topic in late antiquity before the emergence of Islam. So what I would argue is that the Quranic discussion on teleology could fruitfully be read in the context of and in conversation with this late antique debate. Thank you.